And welcome to the Midday with Norman and Stephanie.
Good afternoon. And also with Jonathan Biss, who's a pianist who comes from a long line of professional musicians and who studied with Leon Fleischer at the Curtis Institute, has won a number of awards, recently performed when Mr. Fleischer won the Kennedy Center Awards. And he has issued 5 CDs, I believe it is. Is that right, Jonathan?
I'm counting. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Solo works by Beethoven, Schumann, Schubert, Mozart, and they have been critically acclaimed. And he is here in town to perform with the Madison Symphony Orchestra. And I'll just have to say, one writer said that it was a thrill to experience this shining young star. So we'll be thrilled to welcome Jonathan Biss to the Midday. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And you have one of the more striking biographies or autobiographies that I've come across. Let me just read the first line. Jonathan Biss was born in 1980. His professional debut preceded this event by several months when he performed prenatally the Mozart A Major Violin Concerto at Carnegie Hall with the Cleveland Orchestra, led by Lauren Mazel.
What a way to start.
It's absolutely true.
You want to explain that one?
Yes. My mother, the violinist Miriam Fried, who's been in Madison several times to play, she continued to perform until she was, I think, extremely pregnant with me, I think 7 or 8 months. And I think somewhat earlier than that, one of the concerts she was giving was a concert with the Cleveland Orchestra at Carnegie. So I was, you know, in a manner of speaking, present for that occasion.
But yeah. Quiet, we hope.
Quiet, yes. And occasionally I've joked that it took me a long time to get my re-engagement to Carnegie Hall. It was at least 20 years.
Well, you know, you don't want to take too much for granted there, even if you're performing at the age of minus several months. You have on your 5 CDs Beethoven and Mozart and Schumann and Schubert. Do you see yourself as having a niche? And if so, how important is that when it comes to making yourself known as a performer?
Actually, no. I don't really see myself as having a niche. And I think actually the best thing that any musician can do is to be interested in as wide a range of repertoire as possible. And when I say wide, I mean wide in terms of style, in terms of period, in terms of genre. I mean, I play a lot of chamber music as well as playing concertos and playing recitals. I think you benefit from knowing a lot of music and living with a lot of music. And even if ultimately your focus shrinks, I think that experiencing as much as possible is always, you know, it's always a boon for a musician.
Is that stressed in the places you attended school? Was it Indiana and was it Cleveland? Was the other one?
Curtis,
in
Philadelphia. Yeah.
How much do they stress that kind of versatility? I mean, do they make it to your advantage to study jazz and other forms of music other than classical?
No, I wouldn't say. I mean, Curtis and conservatories in general are wonderful and do a lot. I think maybe versatility is not what they're known for. They're known for encouraging extreme focus. But that having been said, I think every teacher I ever had encouraged me to be curious. And I think, you know, curiosity ultimately leads to versatility in some way. So I never really felt that I was being asked by anyone to hone in on something and work at it for 27 hours a day. And I mean, I think that was good advice, you know, even though in the end, I mean, I would all equally say that it's important to only play music that you love, and I only do play music that I love. I'm glad that, you know, by now when I look at, if I were to make a list of the pieces that I play, it would be long and it would have a lot of variety on it.
You stress the emotional connection to the music. And in light of the fact that you do so much live playing, how does your personal emotional state at the time that you're on tour, or just say you've had a really tiring week and all of us can get maybe a little down, or on the other hand, if you're just feeling exhilarated and joyful, does that affect the performance, the emotional side of it?
I mean, it certainly does, although I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly how. I don't think it's a direct connection, you know. I mean, the same holds true of composers. I mean, you have, for me, the ultimate example of this is, you know, Beethoven writes the Heiligenstadt Testament, which is one of the more depressing documents ever written.
Despairing, yes.
Yeah, I mean, utterly despairing and without any, you know, if he felt any hope at that point, there certainly was nothing in it to suggest it. And then he wrote the Second Symphony, which is probably the most purely positive piece of music that he ever wrote. So I think, you know, also as performers, sometimes we, you know, if you're having a difficult moment in your life, you play to console yourself, you know, and I think in other times, maybe when life is good, it, in a perverse kind of way, it makes you sort of more aware of the other side of emotion. So I'm sure that, you know, whatever I'm bringing to the stage from my life is important, but I couldn't explain to you exactly how it manifests itself.
Let's manifest a little bit of Beethoven here from his Pastoral Sonata. That'd be number 15 in D. Just a short movement, the third movement, Scherzo, with our guest, Jonathan Biss. Pastoral Sonata of Beethoven, the Scherzo, the third movement, played by our guest today, Jonathan Biss.
Who will be in town performing with the Madison Symphony Orchestra with music of Mozart.
In fact, more about that lately, or in a moment, I should say. In fact, both the Beethoven that we just heard and the Mozart that we are about to hear are on the prestigious EMI label. Now, how did you, at the age of less than 30, land a contract with EMI?
It's the same answer that I give to a lot of questions I'm asked. I was lucky. When I was, I think, 22, I started a relationship with BBC Radio 3. They have a program called New Generation Artists, where they feature young musicians that they choose on radio broadcasts of concerts and also radio recordings, concerts with their orchestras, the BBC orchestras. And one of the things that came out of that was my debut CD on EMI, which they co-produced. I was sort of done between EMI and BBC Radio 3. And I gather that CD was well received. Mm-hmm. And that led to the contract with EMI, which I made a further three records on.
You've done a lot of live recording, it looks like. Do you enjoy that?
I have. My last two CDs, the Mozart on EMI and then the Schubert that I did, the Wigmore, are both live recordings. And I do. I mean, since I've started recording, I've always said that really what I would hope for out of a record more than anything else is that it creates the feeling of a performance, you know, because, you know, what's the alternative if you think of it as something that should be perfect? First of all, what's perfect? And second of all, even if you achieve that in some way, will it seem perfect to you 3 days later? You know, so I think it's a much more valuable thing on a record to try to create the feeling of something that's happening in real time. And so then, once you come to that conclusion, it starts to make a whole lot of sense to make your recordings in real time. And those two recordings that I've done that way are probably my happiest experiences of recording. And when I listen to them back, I definitely hear myself in them, you know. And from a performer's point of view, that's good and bad. I mean, there's always things you're not going to like, but I know that it's me.
It's,
you know,
it's you,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, not to say that the other recordings aren't, but you know, the process by which they're made is so different from what a concert is that in the end, it's your listening starts to get altered. And when I listened in making the editing, because of course there are, you know, you have to have patch sessions in the live recording, you know, both for you and, you know, there are coughs and things like that. But when I did the editing, it was very straightforward. I wanted everything to sound organic in the moment, you know, and, you know, that my path was a lot clearer that way. You know, when you're editing a commercial recording, then you start to think, I hear a little bit of a, you know, of a squeak there, or I think that's sticking out. It doesn't bother me now. Is it going to bother me a year and a half from now?
Right, right.
You know, when you edit a live recording, you don't think that way. You know, you can hear the progress from one note to the next, and whether or not that's the way you hear those notes progressing from one to another the next day, you know that it made sense to you then, and that's what a performance
is
about. That's what live music is for, you know?
Yeah.
So is a live in the sense, I mean, is there a quote, live or real-time recording that's actually done in the studio without an audience, or does that always mean that you're performing in concert?
I've never heard of a studio recording being made in real-time, because as soon as you know that the time is available to you, then you start to think, I don't know about that. I don't know about that phrase. Maybe I'll try it again. No, I mean, all of the recordings that I've made or heard that are live recordings were made in front of an audience, and the audience is important, too. I mean, the audience is, you know, I always think of a performance is this three-way conversation between the composer, the person who wrote the music, the performer, the person who's playing it, and the audience, the people who are listening to it. And, you know, of course, when you make a commercial recording, there is ultimately an audience of people who will listen to it in their homes. But I'll tell you, it's hard. It's hard to imagine them when you're staring at a red light bulb, you know, which says, which means the microphone is on.
It's a more sterile process.
It doesn't look like an audience to me, you know?
Well, that goes back as far as radio, doesn't it? I mean, when you think about it, or actually even further with the first recordings, must have been a challenge to perform when there seemed to be nobody there and everything was kind of displaced.
Absolutely. No, I think it's music really, more than anything for me, is about communication. And I think the closer you come to the feeling of communication in a recording, certainly the happier I am. I think many of us performers feel the same way.
You're going to be performing the Mozart Piano Concerto No. 9, known as the Jeune Homme, but apparently that might be somewhat of a red herring.
Yeah, that keeps getting edited. They're calling it the Jeune Ami Concerto. I think it's after the woman for whom it was written and who played the premiere of it.
Yeah, there's some confusion about some of those Mozart concertos, flute quartets even, as to exactly what was the name of the person for whom he was writing this.
Yeah.
It's still a little muddled after all these years.
Well, what is actually very clear, though, when you look at the score and when you listen to this, is that it was written for someone else. I mean, most of the concertos he wrote for himself, and there are certainly moments in, you know, in the texts where you have the feeling that he would have fleshed it out somewhat. In this concerto, every single ornament is written, which is, I mean, lucky us to have at least one piece by Mozart like that, so we have an idea of maybe what he sounded like when he played these pieces himself.
So the cadenza is all his.
Every note. I mean, this is the only concerto of Mozart I play where I don't add anything, because it's so beautifully worked out on the page.
Well, as for the 21st and its successors, half a dozen of them, those probably were all written for Mozart himself to perform.
Yeah, absolutely. And therefore, most of them in that series don't have cadenzas that he wrote down, so we have to commit our own sins.
Well, here's the finale of the very, I suppose, the most famous of all the Mozart piano concertos, at least for now, number 21 in C. And here you're playing with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, our guest, Jonathan Biss. And they're particularly charming, the energy in the finale of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21 in C. Jonathan Biss, the soloist with Orpheus Chamber Orchestra.
And he'll be performing the music of Mozart with the Madison Symphony this weekend. That's the Piano Concerto No. 9, and that'll be this Friday, Saturday, and then there's a Sunday matinee performance as well. I'll give the information if you'd like to find more. It's at jonathanbiss.com. You've got your tour schedule up. But for the specifics here in Wisconsin, madisonsymphony.org or at 608 258 4141.
You more and more into, websites and all those ancillary Facebook things and Twittering and blogging.
I'm not a tweeter. Is that the
Twitterer?
I do not tweet. I am not a Twitterer.
No tweet.
I'm not just to tweet and not to tweet. I'm not on Facebook, but I do think of my website as a means by which I communicate with people who are interested in me and hopefully fellow music lovers. Yes, I mean, a cautious yes, I would say. I mean, I think more than anything else, it's just as much as I think social media are really interesting, I think, first of all, there's the problem of it being very, very time-consuming to operate them.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, it's not that I in any way would find them to be an invasion of privacy. I don't think there's, because you can control how much you want to do on these sites. But it's more that, I feel... It's being in the public eye to the limited extent to which classical musicians are even is a double-edged sword. And I think that the existence of all of these social media mean that today you can be concerned with your relationship with the public, with public image and with image in general 24 hours a day if you allow yourself to. And I think that that's damaging. I think that you need to preserve time for yourself to remember what it means to feel to feel like yourself independently from other people's perception of you, outsider's perception.
Separate yourself from the image.
I think it's very, very important, and I think that hopefully what an audience goes to a concert wanting to hear is the performer's relationship with music in the purest possible way. And I think to be able to express that, you need distance. You need to preserve something for yourself.
That's where you can be transparent, is on stage with the piano.
I think so. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you aren't a little bit careful about separating yourself from the way every act, musical or otherwise, that you engage in is going to be perceived, then you start to lose the purity of your relationship with music. And that, for me, that's there's nothing that's more important to me than that, and maintaining that and living with that and building on it and growing with it.
Before you take off, Jonathan, which I know you have to do, tell us, what did Schubert do for the piano that Beethoven didn't?
What did Schubert do for the piano that Beethoven didn't? Well, Schubert was not a pianist, really. I mean, he played the instrument, of course. But he was not, on the one hand, maybe interested in the sort of sumptuous possibilities of the instrument, but because it wasn't his instrument particularly. But I think at the same time, he also was not... shackled to what were considered to be the limitations of it, because it was an instrument that he was playing professionally. And so there is a kind of a freedom and a sort of a flowering lyricism that takes place in Schubert's piano sonatas, which is really unique to him. I mean, of course, everything Schubert touched had that quality.
Yeah, I was just reading today about his Ninth Symphony, and again, distinguishing it from Beethoven. Lyricism is like a series of songs unfolding.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I find so unique about Schubert's piano sonatas, which I think was an inspiration to many composers who came after him, was the way in which they're unhurried. He allows himself so much space to develop his ideas, and he's not shackled to any preconceived ideas of form, and because of that, there's this kind of spirit of generosity in the music, which is very uniquely his. It's Schubert through and through.
Well, let's hear some of it, and thank you for being with us today, Jonathan Biss.
Really appreciate your coming in today, and hope you have a wonderful weekend with the Madison Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you very much.
This is the second movement of the two movements of the piano sonata in C of Schubert, as played by our guest, Jonathan Biss, on the new Wigmore Hall Live label. In fact, this is the first CD in that series.